Part of the Contemporary Halacha series, Rabbi Yonah Ries, on the topic of Beis Din and Erkaos.
Okay, so the topic today is Beis Din and Erkaos. It's a very broad topic, and we'll try to cover the material in the time that we have in as efficient a manner as possible. But as usual, please feel free to ask questions as we go along, and I will be happy to interrupt at any moment in order to take any questions that are posed by any of the Talmidim. So there is a pasuk in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim, Eilu Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem, that teaches us, as Rashi points out on that pasuk, Lifneihem v'lo lifnei ovdei kochavim mazalos, that when you have cases that need to be submitted for adjudication, there are disputes between different litigants within the Jewish community, then the Torah tells us, Asher tasim lifneihem, that the mishpatim, the disputes regarding the different laws, should be brought in front of them, meaning in front of the Jewish judges that we spoke about before Parshas Mishpatim. In Parshas Yisrael, we spoke about appointing judges. So these judges are supposed to be the ones to adjudicate any disputes, and not any non-Jewish judges. We're not supposed to go to non-Jewish courts. So, even if you know that there's a particular din where their laws are essentially the same as our laws, nonetheless, you should not bring any adjudication to their court. Because anybody who brings any case before their court system, because it says that our judgments are not theirs, our God is not like their idolatry. But when we are submitting our cases, our judgments to the secular courts, to the idolatrous courts, then that is giving a tribute basically to their credibility, as if somehow we are not able to sustain a society with our own system of divine law, of Torah law, and we have to look towards them in order to regulate our conduct and regulate our community. So, therefore, that is obviously problematic and is described essentially as a chilul Hashem. Yes? So the Tashbait says no. He says even if we're dealing with the Muslim courts, he specifically describes the same thing would be true, because there are really two aspects to the problem that is described by Rashi. One aspect of the problem is that you're giving a glorious name to the idolatry by turning to them for guidance. But the other problem is that you are mechalas Hashem by indicating that the Torah system of law is insufficient to be able to regulate our conduct. So that would be true. If you go to any kind of secular system of law, it would be as the Rambam describes it in Hilchos Sanhedrin, Perech Vav, Halacha Zayin. It would be somebody who is Vehevim Yad, Vitoras Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Rambam says, Ve'ela Shinemar, Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem, Lifneihem Lo Lifnei Goyim, uses the more general term, at least in our text, Lifneihem Lo Lifnei Hedyotos, that we learn from here that there is a general prohibition of Lifneihem Lo Lifnei Goyim, because whenever you are going outside, you are departing from the framework of the Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, so that is included within the prohibition. Tashbait, incidentally, understands this is a Torah prohibition. That would seem to be the simple understanding, since it is, after all, derived from a pasuk. It would be essentially a lav abba mitoch essay, which has at least the status of an essay that we of a positive commandment that we derive from the pasuk of Eilam Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem. Despite the fact that this is a very clear prohibition, that one is not allowed to go to the secular courts, nonetheless, it is one that was and has been commonly violated throughout the centuries. So whatever the reasons for this may have been, I guess an obvious reason would be that the Jews found themselves in secular lands, and when you're in secular lands, so the general court system in the society around us has been the secular court system. And therefore, it was not uncommon and not surprising that members of the Jewish community who belonged to the broader society would sometimes look towards that court system. Certainly, that would be the place where they would go if there was a dispute, for example, with somebody who was not of the Jewish faith, who was not likely to come to Beit Din. And therefore, it was a part of everybody's purview. And on occasion, people would go so far as to actually look towards the secular court system in order to summon their Jewish neighbors with whom they would have disputes. And this was already decried. If you look in the Mishnah Berurah, in Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, so the Mishnah Berurah makes a statement that one has to be very careful when appointing a Shliach Tzibor, somebody who is going to represent the congregation in prayer and supplication during the Yomim Noraim before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that if it's somebody who has utilized the Arkos, somebody who has utilized the secular court system, then they should not, under any circumstances, be chosen as the Shliach Tzibor. So we see that it definitely was a problem. Another part of the problem was that as the autonomy of Jewish communities has declined, and certainly in this country, in America, where there is much less of an autonomy of the rabbinic establishment over all matters relating to the community in each and every community, there was less of a notion of the Rabbanim being able to sustain viable and effective courts that would be capable of handling all of the disputes and capable of enforcing their judgments in the event that cases would come before them. So based on a combination of these circumstances, this has unfortunately been a mitzvah, a requirement, a halacha that has come under regular violation. So in recent years, obviously, we've tried to remedy this. I think that if you would have looked at newspaper clippings going back maybe 20 years ago in the Jewish community, you would be hard-pressed to find too many articles about people going to Beis Din, the Beis Din did this, the Beis Din did that, why doesn't the Beis Din do the following, we need the Beis Din to do to make the following tikkunim for the community. It wasn't really part of the nomenclature. Shuls, yeshivas, maybe even mikvahs, certain Erevin, certain other institutions were part of the general communal nomenclature, but Beis Din really wasn't. Beis Din was maybe you knew of a couple that needed to go get a divorce, they would go to Beis Din to preside over the get, but it wasn't really part of the mainstream communal structure when it came to figuring out what to do with vexing communal policy problems, when it came to major disputes amongst members of the community. So all that, I think, has changed very positively over the last 20 years or so. Part of it was the revitalization and reconstitution of the Beit Din of America, which was the Beit Din affiliated with the Rabbinical Council of America, where I was privileged to serve as a director for a number of years. And one of the ways in which the community was brought back into the world of Beis Din was to have Dayanim who would be proficient not only in the halacha and choshen mishpat and the like, but also in with respect to the contemporary commercial marketplace, so that litigants would be comfortable that cases were heard by rabbis and dayanim who were very much in touch with their modern-day realities, because, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, we learn from tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, the extra repetition of the word tzedek, a number of different halachos, and one of the halachos that we learn from the extra word tzedek is holech ha-chabez din yafeh, that the community has the responsibility in each door to establish bati din that are yafeh, that are responsive and attractive to the communal needs in order to help to facilitate an appreciation for this halacha. And then we saw also kind of a rebound in people, even in general society, utilizing alternative dispute resolution, going for mediation, going for arbitrations in front of other arbitration panels like the American Arbitration Association and the like. And also there was a resurgence of general observance, I believe, in the Orthodox community. So all of these different factors, number one, resurgence in observance, number two, an appreciation for alternative dispute resolution mechanisms outside of the court system, which wasn't so great anyway, and number three, the fact that that Batei Din started to make a concerted effort to be more responsive to the needs of the community, to be more careful, to render decisions in a way that would be enforceable as well, in accordance with the dictates of the secular court system, which says that whenever three people get together, or any people get together, to arbitrate a case, and the litigants accept their jurisdiction, and they sign an agreement, and then a decision is rendered, that decision can be enforced in court. So all of these factors together has led to a resurgence in terms of the popularity, in terms of the stature of Beis Din. And now, if you open up a newspaper, you open up a Jewish periodical, you'd be hard-pressed to go too long without seeing a mention of Beis Din in some sort of a context. So that's really been a very positive sea change over the last couple of decades, and I hope that it will continue to move in that direction, L'shem L'sifaris, in a way in which Batei Din act and earn reputations which are going to be exemplary and will only enhance the luster of the Beis Din and the promotion of the pristine and beautiful nature of our divine system of Torah law. So that's just kind of for starters. For starters, we have this basic prohibition. The prohibition is mentioned kind of derech agav in the Gemara in Gittin and Daf Peches Amud Beis, where the Gemara there brings it in a different context, where the case there was that there was no Beis Din Mumchin, there was no Beis Din made up of Musmachim who had been ordained from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, which would seem to violate the requirement of Lifneihem Lo Lifnei Hadyotos. Remember, the Pasuk has two components. Lifneihem, you have to go in front of Dayarim, they should be Mumchim, they should be experts, they should be Musmachim from Moshe Rabbeinu and not Hadyotos, not just stam people. And Lifneihem Lo Lifnei Akum, and they should be Jewish law judges as opposed to secular judges. So the Gemara there asks how Beis Din has any authority nowadays, given that we don't have Mumchim, we don't have Musmachim from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, they're not a continuation in the pristine line of expert judges. So the Gemara there explains that we have the ability to function without having mumchen because it's anan shlichusayo kavdinan, because we are considered to be agents of the mumchen who at that time were in Eretz Yisrael. And Tosfos says that nowadays when we don't have mumchen either in Eretz Yisrael or in Chutz La'aretz, so we rely upon the notion of shlichusayo de kamaika avdinan, that our dayanim are essentially agents, not only in place but also agents in time of the mumchen of the dayanim who existed in days of old, who were direct mumchen, direct musmachin from Moshe Rabbeinu, so therefore we're able to function as dayanim according to the same basic principle. But the Ramban points out that there is one very important distinction between the prohibition of lifneim lo lifnei hadyotos on the one hand and lifneim lo lifnei akum on the other hand. When it comes to lifneim lo lifnei hadyotos, when it comes to going in front of judges who might not necessarily be expert judges, who might not necessarily have the most authoritative smicha, people can always be makabel upon themselves that they're going to go to those judges. That's a decision, an agreement that individuals can privately make. They can say, okay, this person's not a mumkeh, but I will accept him upon myself as a dayan, and I will accept this Beis Din upon myself as a Beis Din, even though the Beis Din is not made up of the most outstanding scholars in mumkeh. But when it comes to the second part of the prohibition, lifneim lo lifnei akum, that you're not allowed to go in front of non-Jewish courts, so that's already much more in the realm of an absolute ritual prohibition, which you're not allowed to contract around. Even if both parties say that they agree to go to a secular court, says the Ramban, they don't have the ability to do that. That would be masna mashikasu b'torah. That would be making a tenai. That would be making a condition which is in a flagrant violation of that which is required by the Torah. Yes.
Why just answering Gittin that we all accept we are Mohan, we are not judged by any other, and that's why
the Gemara in Gittin was talking about a certain power of the Beis Din. So there are really two aspects to the notion of Hedyotos. One is that there's no Isser involved in going in front of Hedyotos, but then there's a secondary question, which is what power do the Hedyotos have? There's a certain power which is only vested in a genuine Beis Din structure. So, for example, if you have a Geiris that needs to be performed. So Geiris, according to Torah law, Mishpat Echad Yelachem has to be done by a, since Mishpat is written with respect to Gerim, it has to be done by a Bezdin. It has to be a bona fide Bezdin. So even if I accept upon myself something that's not bona fide, the Torah says that in order for the Gerus to work, I need a bona fide Bezdin. So then I need to explain that those who are appointed to function in the capacity of Bezdin somehow have that authority, somehow have that stature. How is it that they have that stature? They have that stature based on Shlichusayu Ka'avdinan, based on being agents of the former Mumchin who used to exist. And then the Gemara discusses in Baba Kama just how far that principle of Shlichusayu extends. Does it extend to all cases, or do we say only certain types of cases? The Gemara says it only extends to certain types of cases. Milsa de Isbeh Chisaron Kis, those cases where people stand to lose money, like, for example, there's a contract transaction, there's a hodah, somebody admits that he owes money from something that he borrowed, there's a halvah, there's a loan transaction. So things that commonly occur are included within Shlichusayu. Those things which, it has to be Milsa de Yesha de Isbeh Chisaron Kis, which are milsa de shchicha and which occur on a regular basis. But if it's either something which does not have chisaron kis, or it's a milsa de lo shchicha, something that doesn't occur on a regular basis, like we assume that the notion of animals attacking people, this discussed in the Gemara, is not something that occurs on a regular basis, then that would not be included within the jurisdiction of shlichusayu. Nonetheless, Bezdin can still function to the degree in which they are accepted by individuals who agree to go to Bezdin, because that's the law. You're supposed to go to Bezdin and not secular court, but they don't have the authority with respect to non-chisaron kis matters that would be normally only vested in a pristine Bezdin of Mumkin, like, for example, to issue knossos, to issue penalty rulings. So nowadays, a Bezdin can convene, and every case should be brought to Bezdin, but Bezdin doesn't have the ability to issue the type of knossos rulings that were reserved for Mumchim, because knossos don't relate to milsa d'yesh bo chisaron kis. It doesn't relate to loss of money. Knossos are additional payments or penalties that are required in addition to any out-of-pocket money that a person may have lost. But going back again to the essential halacha, so this is a halacha that simply cannot be renegotiated, meaning that if you have individuals who say that we don't, just like you're allowed to make a tanai shbedava shebemamon, we pasken like Rabbi Yehuda, in monetary matters, I can make a tanai that I am going to have a different kind of framework than that which is required by the Torah. Shoel is normally obligated in onsin, and a shoel can stipulate, this is a mission in Baba Metzia, on Daf Tzadi Beis, a shoel can stipulate that he will not be responsible for onsin, for accidents that occurred to the object that he borrowed. You have the ability to make a tanai shebemamon, or a shomer chinam, who's normally not obligated in Geneva Va'aveda, can stipulate that he will be obligated in Geneva Va'aveda. However, when it comes to this particular law, so the Chiddush of the Ramban is that this is not simply a davar shebemamon. It's not simply a monetary law that parties can contract around, that they can say, well, it's okay, we both agree that we're not makpid about going to secular court, and we're both going to go to secular court. It's still going to be a problem, because this is not a davar shebemamon, this is a davar shebeisr. This is something which is a chilul Hashem, and parties can't just agree amongst themselves that they're going to create a chilul Hashem. So it's beyond the notion of a davar shebemamon. That is the simple halacha. There is a sema in a couple of places who seems to indicate that if the parties have directly and explicitly stipulated that if there's a certain type of schus that they wouldn't be able to get in a bezdin, that they would only be able to get in civil court, then the civil court would actually have jurisdiction over the case based on their tanai. The Taz is absolutely livid in Siman Chabav and Shulchan Aruch about this comment of the Sma, and says that it absolutely cannot be, because this would be Masna Amashikasu B'Torah. This is absolutely impossible. And the Taz goes even further and says that the Sma implies that not only would parties be able to stipulate that they can go to civil court if there's an extra schus that they would get there that they wouldn't get in Bezdin, But in the event that the extra schus is something that the dayanim would be able to enforce, or the dayanim would be able to implement without getting into trouble, they would have the authority according to law to be able to judge according to secular law, and that's what the parties empower the judges to do, that would also be okay. And the Taz disagrees with the Sma at first blush on both counts in Siman Chaf Vav. However, it's not entirely clear that the Sma completely disagrees with the Sma on the second point, because in Siman Samach Aleph, I have this in the Maror Makomos as well, the Taz elaborates a little bit more on what he means, and in Siman Samach Aleph, the Taz indicates that it is possible that maybe what he means is simply that you can't make a stipulation in Bezdin that you're going to follow civil court when it will create an actual Isser. Like, for example, if the parties stipulate that there won't be cancellation of their loans upon the conclusion of the Shemitah year. But if they do it in a Derech Shel Heter, you know, like, for example, the Gemara Mako says you can't say, you can't make a loan, Amanash Loti Shemitani Shvius, that the Shvius, you can't make a loan on condition that the Shemitah year will not cancel out the loan. But you can make a loan that Amanash Loti Shemitani Bishvius. You can make a loan that I recognize and I accept the notion of the Shemitah year, but between you and me, even though the Shemitah year is going to cancel out the loan, we agree that you'll pay me back anyway. That's considered to be okay. So the Taz indicates that as long as the formulation is in accordance with halacha, even if it's a formulation that's against the default to Torah principle, then that stipulation really could, in fact, be upheld by a Bezdin. This is a major raging dispute. There are those, because the question is as follows. We know that there's an Issur HaKos, that you can't go to secular court, and this is even if the secular court has the same rules as the Bezdin, but certainly in most cases they're going to have different rules than the Bezdin. They're going to have the secular court system, and even if both parties agree, they can't agree that they're going to go to a secular court. But what if both parties agree that they're going to go to Bezdin, but they empower the Bezdin to decide in accordance with secular law? So many understand that this is indeed the machlokas between the Sma and the Taz. So this might be wrong on two levels. It might be that really the machlokas between the Sma and the Taz is much deeper than this, because the Sma, I have to just emphasize, is a shitas yachid. Nobody holds this way. But the Sma seems to go so far, and the Sma, because even the Rishonim that the Sma is reading to base himself upon, don't seem to say what he says that they say. But the Sma seems to say that you could even stipulate that you'll go to civil court when it offers a remedy beyond that of the Bezdin. And the Taz clearly disagrees with that. So that's the machlokas, the Sma and the Taz. It could be that the question as to whether you go to Bezdin and you say to Bezdin, I want you to decide according to secular law, as long as the secular law does not create an Isser, you're not violating Shemitah, you're not violating Ribbis, you're not violating any other Isser, it's possible, based on the comments of the Taz and Siman Samach Aleph, that the Taz doesn't really disagree with the Sma about that, and even the Taz would agree that you're allowed to do this. This is a major raging dispute out of Yom HaZeh. There are poskim in both directions as to whether parties can stipulate that the Bezdin will decide in accordance with the secular law. And it doesn't seem to depend upon how Haredi the posek is. It just cuts really across the board in different directions how you understand the basic sources. Rabbi Bleich writes in his Menesiva Sahalacha that the Yisra Arkos extends to two situations. Number one, if you go to secular court, or number two, if you agree that you'll have your dispute adjudicated according to secular law. He holds that is an absolute Isser of our cause. If you look at, for example, the Minchas Yitzchak, the Dayan Weiss, so he has in one of his chuvos that he thinks that the Sma and the Taz were only really arguing about going to secular court, but in the event that everyone agrees they'll go to Bezdin, but just stipulate the Bezdin follows secular law because that's the law that the parties are accustomed to following in their business transactions, he thinks that both the Sma and the Taz would agree that it's perfectly acceptable. And others think that it's just a machlokas between the Sma and the Taz, such as, for example, the Minchas Tzvi, a well-known Dayan author nowadays, seems to understand the whole thing as a machlokas, the Sma and the Taz. So how do you deal with this particular issue? So this came up actually in recent times in connection with the Bezdin of America prenuptial agreement, because what happened was that a lot of women were saying that when it came to a divorce, if they ever had a divorce dispute, they didn't want to go to Bezdin because they thought that the default system of halacha would be more favorable to men than women in terms of the division of assets. And therefore, that was one of the reasons, even though it's not a legitimate reason to violate halacha, but that was one of the reasons that they didn't want to agree to go to Beis Din, and they were going to secular court to file their divorce disputes, which is, of course, a violation of the halacha. So a number of rabbanim turned to Rav Zalman Nachem Goldberg in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Zalman Nachem Goldberg said, no problem, I have a perfect solution. My solution is that why don't you just put in the submission agreement to the Beis Din, the parties will agree to go to Beis Din, and you'll give the parties the option to agree that the Beis Din will decide the case in accordance with secular law, in accordance with the principles of secular law, and that way you'll avoid the Issa or Kals, and you'll be able to satisfy the reservations of some of the women from going to Beis Din. This is assuming that the husbands would agree to sign this as well, but the trick was to get this decided, to get them to sign it as they're about to get married rather than as they're about to get divorced, so that way they would be more positively inclined to sign whatever is put in front of them at the Chasson's Tisch, and at that time they would agree that they would submit to the Beis Din for the Beis Din to decide in accordance with the principles of secular law regarding the distribution of assets. So this led to a little bit of an outcry. There's an exchange that I have here in the materials between Rav Tzvi Gartner, whom we very much respect, and Rav Zalman Nachem Goldberg, in which Rav Gartner complained that he thought that this sounded a little bit like a violation of our cause, because after all, you're accepting a secular system of law upon yourself. And he quotes from the Minchas Tzvi, who had a kind of interesting solution when parties wanted to do this sort of thing. What did the Minchas Tzvi say? He said that in Eretz Yisrael, people would often sign real estate contracts, and they would say that any disputes will be decided according to the Chok HaMekarkoyim. It will be decided according to the real estate statute. And there was some very long 50-page real estate statute, I guess, on the books in Israeli law, which is technically not a halakhic legal system. It's a secular legal system. And the question was, is this considered to be acceptable or not for parties to contract in this fashion? And he ruled that, well, it depends. We know that called davashe b'mamon, they're called tanaishe b'mamon kayom, that you can make any condition when it comes to monetary matters. So strictly speaking, if they looked at this statute and they looked at the 50 pages of provisions and said, oh, we think that we'd like to conduct ourselves according to these 50 pages of provisions, not because we want to follow secular law, but just because we think that this is a representation of the deal of our particular transaction. So he says, so that's fine, but just instead of referencing the real estate statute, you have to just incorporate all 50 pages of provisions into the contract. Say, and we have agreed that we're going to subject ourselves to the following provisions, and then just lift or list off the 50 pages or so. And that way you're not explicitly accepting upon yourself the secular law, you're just accepting upon yourself a certain set of conditions that, lo and behold, what do you know, happens to be consistent with the secular law.
Right.
So Rav Tzvi Gartner wasn't so impressed by this distinction. He said that it seems like it's really just semantics to him. The Maisa, what you're doing is you're accepting upon yourself that system of law without saying so explicitly.
Meaning, I don't know how it would, if it's just a technical thing, so then that may make sense, but the issue is that Chilul Hashem, so I don't know how that would
obviate.
Right, unless you say that there's no Chilul Hashem, as long as you're submitting yourself to the jurisdiction and the determination of the Dayanim in the Beis Din to ultimately decide the case and determine to what degree they're going to incorporate your various stipulations. That's really what Rav Zalman Nachem Goldberg says. So Rav Zalman Nachem Goldberg, in response, this is on page 16 of your materials, this was all in the Yeshurun journal, so it was all published, this correspondence. So Rav Zalman Nachem Goldberg said he thinks that even, technically speaking, even if you explicitly incorporated the actual statute into the arbitration agreement, he thinks it's perfectly fine, because why can't a person be mechayev himself to do more than that which the Torah requires? Just like the Shomer Chinam can obligate himself to have all of the obligations of a Shomer Sachar, so by the same token, he didn't see why a husband couldn't take upon himself to have more obligations towards his wife based on whatever the secular laws are of a property distribution. So he thought that Miyekar Adin, even if you explicitly incorporated the secular law, it would be perfectly acceptable. He just threw in that if you really want to be extremely worried about this and nervous about this, so fine, so do do it the Minchas Tzeris way and just incorporate, you know, the various provisions without mentioning the laws. I think that the Bezin of America, at the end of the day, we sort of incorporated some sort of a pshara based on this discussion. And the pshara was along the lines that instead of saying we accept upon ourselves New York law, in the event that there's ever marital disputes, so we gave parties the option. It's all an option. In the Bezin America agreement, you can click off any number of boxes. You could say, we want Bezin America to decide the way it normally decides, whatever that is. Or you could say, we want Bezin America to decide in accordance with equitable distribution principles customarily employed by secular law. So that's kind of like the formulation. We're not saying we're accepting upon ourselves secular law. We're saying we're accepting upon ourselves the minhag ha'makom. So there's a minhag that's followed by everybody. We have the right to accept upon ourselves the minhag, even though it happens to be consistent with secular law. Rather than saying we're accepting upon ourselves a secular law regime, we just are saying that we want the Beis Din to employ equitable distribution principles as customarily employed by a secular law. So that's kind of the pshara language that the Beis Din came up with, which I think, by the way, that really does work mi'ikar hadin, because it seems to me that there's no real machlokas here, that even the Taz agrees that if you stipulate even to the secular law rules in your Beis Din contract, as long as you're not incorporating anything which is downright usur, like violating Shemitah or violating Ribbis, it seems to me that even the Taz would agree that that's okay. Yes?
Are all these issues that would be two Jews or even Jew and a non-Jew?
So these issues are, we'll jump the gun a little bit, but I don't mind jumping around. It's generally understood that the Pasuk is talking to Klal Yisrael, and the Pasuk says that when you have internal disputes within Klal Yisrael, you have to go to Pneihem, you have to go to the Bati Din, rather than going to La'akos, rather than going to the secular courts. It happens that the Tashbates, based on a Medrash, which I think he quotes it from the Shi'iltos, but it's not actually in the Shi'iltos, but I think it might be in the Tanhuma. The Medrash seems to say that if you have a dispute with a non-Jewish person, you're really not supposed to take him to a secular court. You should take him to a Beis Din, because the Medrash quotes the pasuk that we say in Tehillim you're not supposed to supposed to go to their system, that they don't know our mishpatim. We're not, even if we're dealing with a goy, if you're dealing with a non-Jewish person, you're not supposed to go to the secular court. So what then would be the basis, if you assume like that Tashbates, for the fact that we don't take them to the secular courts? That's based on something else entirely, that we don't take them to Beis Din. It's based on something else entirely, which is namely that if you have a Jewish party, as we're going to see, and the Jewish party refuses to go to Beis Din, so then Beis Din gives reshus for you to take that Jewish party to a secular court, because you have the right to a remedy somewhere. If he refuses to go to Beis Din, then you can take him to secular court. So there's a discussion. What if it's a Jewish party who you know for sure is not going to want to go to Beis Din? Can you just take him straight to secular court? Do you need to get permission from Beis Din? So many say, including the Kesef Kachim and the Shulchan Aruch, that if you know for sure that he's not going to go to Beis Din, you can just take him straight to secular court. So the argument is, regardless of how you paskin in that question of the Kesef Kachim with another Jewish party, when it comes to a non-Jewish party, it's pretty much safe to take for granted that unless he indicates otherwise, he's not going to want to go to Beis Din, and therefore you can just go and take him straight to secular court. But in the event that you actually have a non-Jewish party who comes to you and says, I want to go to Beis Din, so then, this is brought down in the Kovetz Poskim, it is in fact appropriate under those circumstances, based on the Tashbates, based on this Medrash, to listen to him, to heed his request, to have the matter heard in Beis Din as opposed to secular court. I mean, during my years in the Beis Din America, we had at least two cases that I remember. There was a non-Jewish party who wanted to take the Jewish party to Beis Din as opposed to secular court. Why? Because the non-Jewish party felt that the Jewish party would have more respect and deference for the Beis Din's rulings, would be more likely to comply quickly with whatever the Beis Din decided than if they would go to the secular court system. One of them was even a $100 million case brought by a major national bank. They felt that if they brought the case that in secular court, they wouldn't be able to collect anything because the person would find the way of hiding their assets. But if Beis Din would hear the case, the person would have enough deference and respect for Beis Din that if the Beis Din said you have to pay a certain number of millions of dollars, that the person would pay that amount of money. And I remember that case very fondly. Yeah.
Are we assuming that Israeli court is secular court in the sense that so recent?
Yeah, so the Chazanish writes that in the event, let's say, here's where you kind of have to break this question down a little bit. If I have two people who say that they want a particular case to be decided according to principles of secular court because that's consistent with their custom of dealing. So that is not a complete abrogation of the Torah system of law. That's a tenai in a particular case, just like if a Shomer Chinah makes a tenai in a particular case, that we treat it like a Shomer Sakar, we're not doing away with the whole sugya of Arba Shomim as a result. But if you have an entire community of Jews that say, we're not going to have Torah law at all, we're just getting rid of Torah law, and we're going to have an entire system which is predicated upon secular law. We'll take a little bit of British law, we'll take a little bit of Turkish law, we'll take a little bit of different legal systems, and we'll plop them together to create essentially a secular legal system. But we, the entire Jewish community, are going to accept that. So the Chazon Ish said, this is certainly included within the Chilul Hashem considerations of what we're talking about, because that really is a complete abrogation and repudiation of Torah law, and therefore the notion of doing that in Eretz Yisrael is completely repugnant. The Chazon Ish is a lashon, interestingly, was that he held it's a violation of Lifneim below Lifnei Hadyotos, that you are creating a system which by definition is all completely Hadyotos because it's secular law. Some seem to understand, certainly the way it's read by Rabbi Black, is that his below Hadyotos is Lav Davka, but it really means Lifneim below Lifnei Akum as well. Just here you're not talking about Akum, so he uses lashon Hadyotos because after what we're talking about Jews, but nonetheless, even if you have an entire Jewish society that would accept that type of a premise, that type of a secular law regime, so that would be problematic. That sentiment was echoed by Tzvi Pesach Frank, was echoed by Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. Many spoke very strongly and stridently about this, and many of these different tshuvos are codified in the tshuva that I have in the materials by Rav Avadya Yosef and the Yechav Adas. We kind of collects these various sources and goes further to say that it would therefore be a gross violation to be a shofet, for example, in this type of a secular regime, which is created by the by a larger Jewish community. This would be clearly a violation. It's one way to understand what's a somewhat controversial tshuva sarashba that's at the crux of this entire dispute. The Rashba in Chelik Bav Siman. See if I can find the Rashba. Okay, I'll get you the exact source. It's in the materials. So the Rashba has a tshuva in which the Rashba seems to say that it would be problematic for Jewish litigants to accept upon themselves a secular court system, or secular laws, I should say, with respect to their particular dispute. It's Chelik Vav Siman Reish Nun Dalet. It's in pages 11 to 12 of the materials. In fact, the Rashba actually says exactly the opposite. But even though he says exactly the opposite, he really says this too, which is why it's kind of difficult to interpret the Rashba. You can read the Rashba for yourself. The Rashba really says both things. So it really depends on which part of the Rashba you focus upon if you want to use the Rashba as a precedent. The Rashba was talking about a case where there was a man, Jewish man, married off his daughter to another Jewish man, and the daughter died and left behind the child, and the child died. And what would happen normally, according to halacha, is that the assets that the woman had would go to her husband, because the husband is Yoresh, his wife, according to Torah law. However, in the country where these people lived, there was a law, and the law was that if a woman dies dies without children, or if she has a child, the child dies shortly thereafter, then all the money, at least that was brought into the marriage by her, rather than going to her husband, like the money of the dowry that she brought into the marriage, all that money goes back to her father. So the question was, in this particular case, nobody had stipulated anything. Nobody had stipulated anything. Would it be appropriate to just follow the secular law, since that was kind of the general practice in that area, to just follow the secular law and say that even though nobody had stipulated to anything, that the Yerusha should go to the father? That was the question that was posed to the Rashba. So the Rashba said, well, of course, people can make any tanai that they want. And in fact, we find that the people would make a tanai that the husband wouldn't inherit the wife, and it would go, and her assets would go to her family. We find that this was done even in the time of the Gemara, and we find this in the Yerushalmi. And even if there was a minog that people would make such a tanai, and in one case people didn't make that tanai, we would assume that it's implicit that they made the tanai because of the fact that they live in that type of a society. So that's what the Rashba starts out saying. But then he says, oh, when we call Malkom, Lino came, Nation Mishpat Goyim. But if you're going to do this because of the fact that this is the secular statue, Ve'emes Nir Elisha Asa, Lefisha Mechakes HaGoyim, that would be Asa, because then you're imitating the Goyim, V'zeo Shisiva Torah Lefneim Lefnei Goyim, that would be Lefneim Lefnei Goyim, Afbi Shishneim Votzim Mechakim, though both of them want to do it that way, V'Dorash HaMamon, and it's a Dorash HaMamon, but you're doing it in order to imitate the Goyim, that would be terrible, Sholi Nicha Torah Sa'ab, Sholi Nachalo, Etzom Shiaikos, Kukas HaGoyim, Dineim Lo'odish, Afilu Lo'amal Lefneim 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 How could they possibly have even considered such a thing? Was a terrible thing? Blah, blah, blah. So he goes on about how terrible and terrible it is. So he basically said both things. So the question was, how do you reconcile what the Rashba said at the beginning, which he also ends up saying at the end as well, by the way, and what he says afterwards in the next number of sentences? Do you just say, well, let's focus on what he was more vehement about? So since he was so incredibly vehement about this part, so this is really the ikar holding of the Rashba. So there are different ways to understand the Rashba. One way of understanding the Rashba is simply like the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef understood that the Rashba was talking about a case, not merely, it was a question of whether the Beis Din should follow the secular law, but where the question was, should the parties just go to the secular courts? So if you understand like the Beis Yosef understands the case, that he was talking, even though it's not really so explicit, that he's talking about where they were going to the secular courts. So we understand. The difference is obvious. The going to the secular courts, you obviously can never do under any circumstances. Going to the Beis Din and stipulating a particular way, so that's something which would be okay. Another way of interpreting the Rashba, so the Rashba was saying, yes, you can contract to follow a certain type of practice, if that's the minhag hamakom, even if it turns out that it's consistent with secular practice and secular law, but you can't do it if you're doing it for the purpose of imitating secular law. That you, if you're doing it not because you love this law, not because this is something which is agreeable to your sense of practice and common custom, but if you're doing it simply because you feel that whatever it is that the secular statutes say, that's what you're going to follow, so that's the problem. That is probably the best and most sensible reading of the simple text of the Rashba that is in front of us. There's a third reading of the Rashba that probably has legitimacy as well, which seems to be hinted at in the letter of Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, which is that the Rashba was saying, well, if in an individual case you have people who want to agree either explicitly or it's clear from their conduct of deal, from their course of dealing, that this is an implicit condition, that they want to follow a certain practice in their monetary dealings, so then that would be okay. But if you have an entire community that's just going to uproot Torah law forever and say, we're never going to follow Torah law, and we're good declaring on behalf of the entire community that we're just going to embrace forever the secular laws regarding inheritance, so then that would be the problem, that it's an uprooting by the entire community, like the Chazon Ish talks about, of the Torah law regime. There's even a fourth way to understand the Rashba, that there's a difference between normal monetary conditions and Yerusha. Yerusha, as the Rambam says, might be something that you really can't contract around, although Yerusha's Habal might be kind of an exception to the rule, because at least between Erisin and Nisuin, you can make a certain contract where the husband can distance himself from the wife's earnings. So the case that the Rashba happened to focus upon is a little bit of a complicated case. The Rashba himself doesn't seem to make the Mammon Isser distinction in the context of Yerusha. So probably one of the right interpretation of the Rashba is one of these three interpretations. Either the Rashba's complaint was that it was talking about a case where they were going to secular courts, or the complaint was that the people were accepting upon themselves a secular law simply because of their adoration for the secular law system rather than because they wanted to follow their particular minhag, or that the Rashba was criticizing the notion of doing a complete overhaul, complete overturning of Torah law for an entire community, as opposed to a private transaction between two parties where it would not have been problematic. Any one of those three interpretations are probably plausible within the Rashba. I would say that based on the wording of the Rashba, the second and the third maybe even more than the first, but even according to those interpretations, what we don't have is a complete repudiation of the Rashba, of the notion of parties in an individual case contracting that they're going to structure their monetary dealings a particular way, or even for the Bezin to decide in a certain way, if their objective is not to throw out Torah law and not to repudiate Torah law as a wholesale fashion. It seems to me that even the Rashba would be in agreement, and in fact he explicitly says so, so it's not like I'm stretching this into the Lashon of the Rashba. It appears, you know, but he says this quite explicitly, that the Rashba would agree that one could make a Tanai under those circumstances. The truth is, even Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in the context of a landlord-tenant question, that when it comes to rent control laws, if you have a landlord that rents that premises for about a year, let's say, to a tenant, and then the year comes to a conclusion, so under Torah law, you don't have to renew the lease. Under secular law, if it's a rent-controlled apartment and the tenant wants to renew the lease, he has the right to renew the lease. So Rav Moshe says that without getting to the question of dina d'malchusa dina, of what it is that the law of the land is binding upon us, which is a very limited in scope, it deals with taxes, things that are the takanas of medina. Some say it applies to rent control laws, but even if it doesn't apply to rent control laws, Rav Moshe says that the reason why this would be binding upon the parties is because it's an implicit tanai, that there is a tanai, there's an understanding that landlords and tenants intend to enter into their contracts with each other in accordance with the minhag hamakom, even if it happens that the minhag hamakom was established by the broader secular society and their legal structure. If that becomes the minhag hamakom of how landlords and tenants relate to each other, so then it's considered as if they made the tanai with each other. So he seems to embrace this idea as well, even when there wasn't an explicit tanai, even when it's only an implicit tanai. And I think you can still reconcile that with a Rashba as long as you're understanding they're doing it based on minhag and not because they're looking to repudiate Torah law and to do a complete overhaul of Torah law in favor of secular law based on some adoration and affection of the secular law regime. Okay, so that is, and there's an article here in which I try to give a little bit of lumdus behind the whether it's necessary, whether it's a problem of explicitly incorporating the secular law, but that's just for your own reading pleasure if you feel like it. That's the article on pages 17 through 25. Where I suggest that it might be a machlokus between the Mishnah Lamelech and the Ktos as to whether it's a problem when you're incorporating secular law to explicitly incorporate the statute, or whether you should follow the eights of the Michas Tzvi and not incorporate the statute. Yes?
According to the three primary Mahalchim and learning of the Rashba, all three would say that following a completely secular law system would be problematic.
Yes, well, community as a whole to completely accept upon itself a secular law system.
So there would be no reading according to these three to...
Right, I don't think so. I think that clearly would be a problem. And that is obviously the approach of... that's the reason why all of the Gedolim, really Chazanish and the Ratzvi Pesach Franken of Yitzchak Isaac Herzog, the Gedolim who dealt with the question as to whether the whole secular system, you know, secular legal system in Israel, since it was being implemented by Jewish judges, whether this was legitimate or not, that they all came out very strongly against it. That there was no grounds for its legitimacy, and this really is based upon this type of distinction. Okay, now... the next question becomes whether it is possible to have a case adjudicated that is not adjudicated in front of a Beis Din. Yes, Mordechai.
I think the first head justice of the Israeli court system was an Orthodox Jew. Is that?
Yes. Well, of course, there were those who.
Did he have a Mahalakan?
There was a Mahalakh. The Mahalakh was based on what we're going to talk about now. So you sometimes have, but it's not a good Mahalakh, really. Okay. But the Rashba talks about our Kol Shebisturya, that sometimes you don't have qualified Dayanim. What if you have a town? This was the tshuva that was posed to the Rashba in Simon Reish Sadi Chelik Base of his tshuvas. What if you have a town in which there are no qualified Dayanim? So you just not have a Bezin altogether? What are you going to do? So the Rashba says, well, the Gemara in Sanhedrin in Perek Vezebora talks about this concept of our Kol Shebisturya, that you might have a location where even the Jewish people are not that learned and not that proficient, but you have to have Jewish law judges, so you appoint people to just use their common sense and good judgment, even though they're not going to necessarily know how to apply Shulchan Aruch, how to apply Halakha so perfectly, but this way you have some sort of an arbitration mechanism in place. So even though it's not a Bezdin according to all of the bells and whistles, but nonetheless it's not pure Akos either. It's not going to Akum. It's what we call Arkol Shebisurya. It's kind of like a Jewish style Arkol Shebisurya. It's a Bezdin type of a structure, but without all of the proficiency and without all of the grounding that a Bezdin would normally have. And as long as they're not kafuf, as long as they're making decisions based on their own seichel hayashar and not based on secular statutes, so this is actually legitimate. So when you look at the Meiri's description of our Kol Shebisurya, the Meiri says, yeah, you'll appoint people and they won't really know what to do because they're not so learned, so they'll use their common sense. Sometimes they'll consult the law books that they understand of the society in which they live, and they'll make judgments accordingly. So those who argued in favor of the whole system of a secular regime in Israel said, well, look at the Meiri. This is like our Kol Shebisurya, because the Meiri says that sometimes they will consult their legal books. So in response to this our Kol Shebisurya argument, basically, Avraham Chaim Sherman in his Divrei Mishpat article and Rav Avaya Yosef as well and others point out that you can't really make this argument for a couple of reasons. First of all, a Kol Shebisurya is very b'di'evit. If you don't have people who are proficient who actually will be able to follow the halakha, but hopefully in all of Eretz Yisrael we'll find, you know, some kolim where, you know, they're learning halakha l'maisa and where they'll be able to actually, you know, serve in this capacity. And number two, even the Meiri didn't say they're bound by the secular laws. The Meiri said, yeah, they'll use their judgment. Sometimes they'll look here, sometimes they'll look there. So that's not what's going on when you're creating a whole secular legal system and all the judges are bound to follow the various statutes. But what the Meiri was talking about was where it was an informal group. They could decide however they wanted. And sometimes if they felt like it, they would look at the statutes of the local government in which they live. But they weren't functionaries of that government, number one. And number two, they weren't bound to follow the various chukim. And that's not even what they did consistently, even according to the Lashon the Meiri. I think that the simple reading of the Meiri bears out the detractors, the critics, more than the proponents in this particular case. But what we do see from the whole notion of Kol Shebisurya is that what's very interesting is that kind of this Lav Abba Mitoch essay is more of a Lav Abba Mitoch essay than an essay. What do I mean by that? And I often say this much to the consternation of the people, there is no mitzvah to litigate in Beis Din. Meaning that the mitzvah really is more the lav that you can't litigate in the secular court system. If you never step foot in Beis Din to litigate a matter in your entire life, you have not committed an isser. It's probably even a good thing. If you stay away from ever having to litigate a dispute, you resolve all of your, you know, little squabbles and quarrels privately. You're able to sit down and work out an agreement. You're able to mediate. You're able to negotiate a solution without ever having to litigate a case in Bezdin. There is no obligation to litigate at least one case in your life in Bezdin. It's not like Shiluach HaKat. You don't have to, you know, have at least that one case that's litigated in Bezdin. And in fact, there are other ways in which you can engage in dispute resolution without actually going to Bezdin. So our Kol Shebisurya is kind of like a low-level Beis Din, more of an informal arbitration style Beis Din, but it's still within the Beis Din infrastructure. But let's say you want to go to just an arbitration panel. Let's say, for example, that you have a contract that says our disputes will be resolved by the American Arbitration Association. So is that an issur? Or do we say that, no, if you're not an actual arkos, you're not actually accepting upon yourself the authority of the secular legal system, so maybe that is a perfectly okay. So this is a whole big discussion. So clearly, if these are Jewish arbitrators, and they're just deciding according to their secular yashar, so then you basically should be okay. But what if these are non-Jewish arbitrators? So the Shach has a little bit of a discussion where there's a question as to what the Shach is saying. This is in Kol Shemishpat Simchat Bei Sifkat and Tes Abav. The Shach seems to say that he would, it depends. If you go, let's say, to a non-Jewish arbitration board, let's say it's the, I don't know, the American Architects Arbitration Board. You enter into an agreement with an architect who's supposed to do work on your house, and you say, in the event that there are any disputes, we'll go to the Board of Architectural Arbitrators. Okay? This is an established board, and they'll decide according to commercial custom. So is that something which is legitimate or not? So Rabbi Akiva Eiger, interestingly, at the very beginning of his comments to Kol Shemishpat, very early on in Kol Shemishpat, Simon Gimel, quoting the Mahar Shach, says that if the Minhag HaSochrim in a particular industry is that all disputes are resolved in front of their arbitration board, that's not an issue altogether. You're not going to Arkos. You're just going to an industry arbitration board, like the Diamond Merchants Arbitration Board. They're not going to decide according to secular law. They'll decide according to whatever are the norms of their particular industry. Did you say Mazal V'chad? Did you not? Things of that variety. And even though it may not be halakha per se, but it's also not a secular law per se, it's just whatever is the Minhag HaSochrim. And therefore, a party can actually insist that if there's a dispute regarding their industry, that they will go in front of the industry arbitrators as opposed to a Beis Din. This is the ruling of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And there's a whole question, is this really true? Should we really paskin that way? But that's what made it to the page in Kol Shemishpat. Rabbi Akiva Eiger is a pretty reliable authority. So that is essentially the halacha. So given that this is essentially the halacha, so how does that work when you're dealing with, say, a non-Jewish arbitrator? So the Shach says that if it's a non-Jewish person, everyone agrees that they're going to adjudicate in front of a non-Jew.
Their opponent is a non-Jew, or the arbitrator is a non-Jew?
The arbitrator is a non-Jew. You have two Jewish parties, and they're going in front of, and they're going to go in front of a non-Jewish arbitrator.
Rabbi Akiva Eiger specifically
was
talking about Jewish arbitrators.
Rabbi Akiva Eiger, api pashtus. Again, he didn't specify. The truth is, Rabbi Akiva Eiger doesn't specify. He just says the person said he wants to go in front of the sochrim of that industry. That's the truth. So the Shach says that it depends. That if the non-Jew is going to decide according to his Seichel Yashar, so that's not an issur or kos. If the non-Jew is, however, going to decide according to the secular law system, so that's a problem. And that basically is also reiterated by the Aruch HaShulchan, that if I have the combination here, number one, you're going to a non-Jew. Number two, it's a non-Jew who essentially views himself as kafuf to the secular court system, so that would be problematic. But if you're going to go, if the parties agree they're going to go in front of the American Arbitration Association, and the arbitrators there just will follow whatever is their common sense, whatever is their secular yashar, maybe, I would go so far, this is me talking, maybe even just Allah the Meiri, maybe they'll consult with legal texts, you know, just to get sort of a better sense of their direction, but they're not kafuf to the secular legal system, so that would seem to be perfectly okay. I enclosed in the materials an article by Rabbi Black about this subject. I said I'm speaking a little bit because I don't want to put words in his mouth. I don't know if he would say what I just said. But Rabbi Black's basic position is that you have two different situations that would be problematic. One situation is if the non-Jewish arbitrator, even if he can use his common sense, has been appointed by the court system, is it a functionary of the court system? What would be an example of this? If you go to small claims court, and so you go to small claims court with another Jewish party, you say, we're going to go to small claims court and have it arbitrated by one of their arbitrators. They don't necessarily have to follow secular law. They can use their secular yasha, but the small claims court is part of the court infrastructure of the secular court system. So that's one problem. And the other problem would be if you go in front of non-Jewish arbitrators who are kafuf, who are adjudicating the case according to secular law. So that's his formulation. Adjudicating the case according to secular law, you tell him to adjudicate the case according to secular law. My formulation would be a little bit different. I would say that it seems to me, going out a little bit on a limb, but People can disagree. It seems to me that the problem is only if the arbitrator is kafu to secular law. If it happens, the arbitrator is going to consult secular law. Maybe one of the parties want the arbitrator to consult secular law, but he's not kafu to secular law, doesn't view himself as kafu to secular law. I'm not so sure that that would be a problem, as long as you're going to him as sort of an independent arbitrator outside of the court system. The Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva in which he appears to be even more makel about this. This is in Chelek Yudal of Simon Sadi Gimel. He talks about homeowners association, and there was a chok. There was a law on the books. Maybe it's a little bit better because it's Eretz Yisrael. He didn't say that that was something he was taking into account. But there was a law on the books which said that in the event that homeowners of any cooperative homeowner association have a neighborly dispute with each other about who's going to mow the lawn, who's going to rake the leaves, whatever, who's going to take out the garbage, whatever it is. Apparently they had disputes all the time. There would be an arbitration board within the homeowners association that would decide all disputes, according to their Seikol HaYashar. So the Tzitz Eliezer was asked, is this a problem if two Jewish neighbors who belong to the homeowners association go to that arbitration board? So Tzitz Eliezer says, no, it's not a problem because they're just using their Seikol HaYashar and they're not bound by the various statutes and regulations that are part of the court system. Now, the Chiddush of the Tzitz Eliezer's case is that this arbitration board was actually, from the simple reading of the Tshuva, appointed by governmental decree. So one could argue that this is similar to kind of like the arbitration taking place under the venue of the small claims court system that's part of the overall court system, because here it was created by governmental statute that said that the homeowners association shall have an arbitration board. And despite the fact that it was created by arbitration statute, nonetheless, it's as silly as it said, since they're only going to use the Seikol HaYashar, this is going to be okay. So to me, that's a bigger Chiddush. Maybe it would only say that Chiddush within Eretz Yisrael, we have the other reasons to be makel that you're not dealing with an Akum altogether, so you don't have the shocks concern, but I thought that was a Chiddush.
Would it matter at all if it was a puzzle to adopt the Torah?
No, because you can accept, Roy Bucker, you can accept anybody. As long as you're accepting the arbitrator, you don't go to arbitration unless you're accepting the person upon yourself. So it really wouldn't matter at that point in time. You can be Mikabel, somebody upon yourself. Another question that sometimes arises is, yes, Ishiya.
Even an actual Picardus, who's UNCTNFP?
Well, if we just said that you can go to a goy, you can go to a non-Jewish arbitrator, so then we don't have that problem, right?
But you can't.
It depends on the case. If we're dealing with a regular arbitration case, so we generally assume you can go in front of a non-Jewish party. You can't go if the person is kafuf to secular law, then it doesn't matter whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish. And if they're not kafuf to secular law, then it also shouldn't matter whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish.
You can't go to a from Jew who's kafuf to secular law because you're being mechabel him.
No, so that's the problem. If he's cuff of the secular, why would he be cuff of the secular? He's only cuff of the secular if he is somehow serving as a functionary of viewing himself as a functionary of the secular legal system. So that could be problematic. Even, according to the Chazon Ish, that could be problematic, even if it's a Jewish judge. Okay, because there are two sides to the problem of the court system in Eretz Yisrael. One is that even an entire community can't accept, upon themselves, a system that is going to be antithetical to halacha and that's going to eradicate the application of halacha altogether. And the second is that if I have any kind of judicial body that views itself as kafuf to the secular court system, so that also appears to be an extension of our kos. Yes. Well, yes, according to Ravadia Yosef, he's just playing into a Chilul Hashem system. So therefore, So if you're talking about America, it's a totally different story. In America, if you have a Jew who's a judge and he's judging between, for example, two non-Jewish parties who have every single right to be inside a secular court system, in fact, they're even fulfilling the halakhic mandate of dinim by setting up a secular court system and having their own system of laws, so then you could be actually facilitating a performance of Zion Mitzvot B'nai Noach by the B'nai Noach, and you could be doing a good thing. It gets more complicated if the parties who come in front of you are both Jewish. What some people do is they say, go to Beis Din. They say, go to Beis Din. I mean, technically speaking, under like the United States Constitution, I don't know if they're supposed to say that, but there are some Jewish judges who will say that, go to Beis Din. Yeah. Okay, so one question that sometimes comes up is, but in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yosef speaks very strongly against it. Which doesn't mean that there weren't those who were more heter. Remember that when the Jewish when the whole court system was established in it. So you did have, as was mentioned before, you did have certain individuals who were arguing for its legitimacy. I'm just pointing out to you that the Gedolei Hora did not agree with that particular point of view. Another question this arises, this is sort of like a little bit of a funny question, but it actually, Maisa Shahaya, it happened to me, as I'm sitting, you know, as Menahel of the Beis Din, so somebody brought a case where it was a question of, the person had, was arguing that they were in somebody else's bungalow colony and their son was riding his bicycle and there was, some sort of, a hole, that, was not, properly, repaired. It was, what do you call those things when there's like, you know, a bump in the pothole? It was a pothole that was not properly, repaired. And as a result, he fell off his bicycle and he broke his leg or something like that, and they wanted to receive damages. So the other party hired a towing, and the towing came to the Beis Din and said that we don't feel that we're obligated to have this heard by Beis Din because this is Niske Bor. And there's a machlokis, achorin, whether Niske Bor, you know, is a subject to Shlichusayu or whether it's not subject to Shlichusayu. So he said that if something is not going to be subject to Shlichusayu because it's not Shkiach enough, whatever, so then there should be no obligation to come to Beis Din. So what does that mean? That if I have a type of case, like, for example, the Gemara says, Gzeilos v'chavos, they're not including within Shlichusayu because they're not sufficiently Shkiach. So therefore, they're not included within Shlichusayu. Does that mean if it's not included within Shlichusayu of the Dayanim nowadays, that you have a right to go to secular court, that there's no obligation to go to Beis Din? So the Beis Yosef, of course, the Sefer HaTrumah. The Sefer HaTrumah says explicitly not so. The Sefer HaTrumah says that all that it means when we say Shlichusayu is not applicable is that the Beis Din doesn't have the authority to decide the case in accordance with the Knossos and things of that variety. But that doesn't mean, like, for example, Boshes. It doesn't have the ability to enforce Boshes. But that doesn't mean that the parties don't still have an obligation to come to Beis Din for Beis Din to decide in accordance with whatever parameters Halakha grants them to decide the case. It might be the case that in certain instances, and this is the article by Rav Chaim Shlomo Shanan, where he quotes very esoteric early Rishonim and Gaonim, whatever, for you won't find this discussion necessarily elsewhere so much, but he dug up, you know, a couple of sources where he found that there are cases where some early authority said that if it's clear that a person is just kind of using the Shlichusayu argument, even if it's before Beis Din, and he's saying, I'm coming before Beis Din just to get out of, for example, having to pay a boshes or something like that. So then if the Beis Din feels that it's restricted from what it's able to decide based on the limitations of Shlichusayu, but the justice of the situation and the migdah milsa of the situation would militate in favor of granting recovery, then in those cases, the Beis Din actually has the authority and prerogative to give a heter al kos to the other side to be able to gain more of a collection in secular court. But the key is, it's coming from Beis Din. The party can't go to secular court to begin with. That's a decision for Beis Din to make. And that's going to segue into the next part of our discussion, which is when is it that Beis Din gives a heter for parties to go to secular courts? When is it permissible for parties to go to secular courts altogether? Yes?
In cases of alternative arbitration, or even, let's say, somebody was over this, how does Beis Din recognize those rulings?
Well, why would Beis Din, you mean if somebody went to a court and they weren't... If it wasn't legitimate to go to court.
Right.
So there are two different sides to that question. One side of the question is, what if a plaintiff wrongly takes a defendant to court? Reuven takes a Shimon to court. And then Reuven, the whole case is heard. And Reuven loses the case, and now he says, oh, you know what, I realized that I made a terrible mistake, I want to do tshuva, and in order to do tshuva properly, now I'm going to come to Beis Din, I'm going to relitigate the case in Beis Din. So the Rama brings two dayos as to whether we allow Reuven to do that, and says that the most sensible day is the first one, which says that no, of course, Reuven can't do that. He already got his one shot at the apple. He already, one bite of the apple. He already litigated the case in court, and he lost. And therefore, he can't come crying to us now. It kind of strikes us as a little bit insincere that he wants to relitigate the case in Beis Din. But what about from the perspective of the defendant? The defendant basically was brought to court, And now, after litigating the case for 2 years, the defendant is not happy with the results, and now he wants to come and relitigate the case to Beis Din, saying it was wrong of the Tobeah to take me to court in the first place, and he did the wrong thing, not me. After all, I was the innocent party. I was just defending myself, and now I want to relitigate the case in Beis Din. So here, there's a very interesting discussion that you'll find in the Sha'arim HaSiyonim Mahalacha, where he quotes various authorities who say that there's even a certain responsibility that devolves on the defendant. That if the defendant did not immediately, when he was summoned to court, immediately try to summon the Tovea to Beis Din, maybe he didn't have to. Maybe he didn't have to, because after all, he's not the one who started the litigation in Beis Din. He was just kind of an innocent victim. But if he didn't move immediately to have the case removed from secular court and brought to Beis Din, so then he argues that at a certain point in the process, he became complicit. He may not be an avayan. He may not have committed an aveira by being complicit, because he wasn't the one who initiated the action. He would have gone to Beis Din to begin with. He was only doing it because it was worth the secular court. But if he didn't try to move it out from secular court immediately, then he can't come crying at the end of the entire litigation that now he wants to insist upon the entire case being relitigated in Beis Din, because at a certain point, once he has significantly participated in the secular court process, he has essentially accepted upon himself the jurisdiction of the secular court.
What is immediately, like a reasonable amount of time, or is there a shear?
So this is a question. It's not really, you know, spelled out so much in the in this particular discussion, but this is actually a question that we have internally discussed from time to time at the Beis Din of America. I think probably the best standard would be at whatever point there is a kind of significant court involvement, meaning that if the person is simply handed with a lawsuit, and then nothing much proceeds in the case for a while, and he hasn't really done anything in response to the lawsuit other than just kind of protect himself from, you know, any kind of deadline that the court set for himself. But otherwise, there are no further motions that have been filed, so that's still relatively early in the proceeding. But if he himself then starts to file counterclaims, he himself starts to issue motions, interrogatories, deposition requests, and the like, and starts to actually participate in a full-fledged fashion in the proceeding, so at that point in time, you can argue that he has forfeited his ability to make the claim that the whole thing is being done against his will, and that he should be able to relitigate afterwards, because then he basically is staking himself on the outcome of this case. And then it would be sort of the same problem if, after staking his own future on the outcome of this case, he wants another bite at the apple after the whole thing is over. So that's sort of the chiddush that is brought down in the name of the Maharsham and others. Yeah. Okay. So so when is it, and on what basis does Beis Din issue a heter arkos? So there are two basic sources for the notion of heter arkos in Beis Din, and we'll try to do this within the next 15 minutes. So the first is the Gemara in Gittin, the Mishnah in Gittin. The Mishnah in Gittin says that if a Beis Din has issued a decree that it's appropriate for a man to give a get to his wife, so then you can go to the secular courts, and ve'ovdei kochavim choftino, so they beat him up. The omim lo ase mashi so omim lecha, and they say to the recalcitrant husband, do what the Beis Din of Yisrael tells you that you're supposed to do. So we see from here that it is appropriate for enforcement purposes on occasion to utilize the secular court system. The second source is the Gemara in Baba Kama on Daf Tzadi Beis Amud Beis. The Gemara with Baba Kama, Daf Tzadi Beis, Amud Beis, where is this? I think it's page 52 in the materials. So the Gemara there says, Amar, hold on, blah, 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 blah. That's funny, I underlined it and I still can't find it. Okay, fine. So it's, Amalei Rabba L'Rabba, Amalei Rabba L'Rabba Bamari, Mani Minah HaMilsa. Oh, no wonder, I underlined it in a different set of materials. Amalei Rabba L'Rabba Bamari, Minah HaMilsa, Dami Inchi, Karis Chava V'Klo Anach. How do we know this principle that people say that if you call your friend and he does not respond to you, Rami Gudaraba Shadi Bay, take a giant wall and throw it upon him. So the Gemara gives the pasuk, Yanti Yatika Lo Tiartim Tumasek Lo Tariot, that since you haven't cleansed yourself from your impurity, therefore you can't be cleansed again. So what in the world is going on over there? So the Rosh very strikingly quotes a Paltoigon, And he says, Apostle Gon understands that this Gemara is not just Stamazoi talking about you invite somebody and he doesn't show up. It's talking about when you summon somebody to a Din Torah and they don't show up. So then we throw the book at him. We throw the wall at him, figuratively, in that we allow the person who was doing the summoning to then pursue his claim in secular court. And that's throwing the wall. We're throwing the secular court wall at this fellow, that basically we're ramming him because of the fact that he has violated halakha and he has refused to submit to Beis Din. So this appears to create two disparate sources as to when it is appropriate to go to secular court. According to the first one, I have a Beis Din ruling and then I'm going and I'm enforcing the Beis Din ruling. According to the second one, I have a non-compliant party who has taken himself out of the realm of Beis Din by refusing to show up to a summons, and therefore I'm allowed to throw the wall at him and pursue the claim in a secular court. What is a possible nafka mina between these two different timing? So Rav Chaim Cohn, who I think is the Voyez Dayan, in his article in Divrei Mishpat, gives a nafka mina in his opinion. In his opinion, he says, we have a machlokas. If you look in the various sources, you look in the Nesivos and others, let's say that the Nitva refuses to go to Beis Din. Are you always allowed to allow the Tovea to pursue any claim in secular court? So the Nesivos says, no, not any claim in secular court. You first have to determine whether this is a claim in which he has the right under halakha to recover damages. Otherwise, it would be gazela. So only after the Beis Din has determined that it's the type of claim where he would have the right under halakha to recover damages can you give him authorization to pursue the claim in secular court. So Chaim Cohen points out that's not the minhag olam. The minhag olam is not that way at all. The minhag olam is that once somebody refuses to go to Beis Din, we don't investigate his claim. We don't determine and ascertain for sure that he has a recoverable claim according to halakha. We just say, go to secular court and collect whatever you can. So what's the basis for doing that? So he says, he thinks it's based upon whether we're understanding the heter based on the Mishnah in Gittin, and whether we're understanding the heter based on the Gemara in Baba Kama. If we understand the heter based on the Mishnah in Gittin, so it's only when there was already Beis Din involvement and Beis Din made a determination of the correctness of a claim that you can then go and pursue it in secular court. But the Gemara in Baba Kama is giving us a further tradition. This is codified by the Rosh and brought down in the Beis Yosef of Palto Igon, saying that there's also an element of Knas here, that it's not merely a question of furthering the psak of the Beis Din, but there's an actual knas on an individual who demonstrates that he steadfastly refuses to accept upon himself the authorization and jurisdiction of the Beis Din. In such a case, you're allowed to throw the wall at him, which indicates that you can throw everything at him, that you can even throw at him that which he otherwise would not have been liable for had he submitted to a Beis Din adjudication. And that is the basis, he says, he thinks, for the minhag olam, which is in fact the minhag olam, that Beis Din, whenever somebody brings a claim to Beis Din, that at least the Beis Din determined was worthy of a hazmana from Beis Din, that at least qualified for a hazmana, not that Beis Din determined that the person would have prevailed in his claim, but at least passes muster of being able to warrant a summons in Beis Din. I think that that is a certain threshold that probably needs to be met, because that's something which, for example, in the Beis Din of America, the Beis Din of America doesn't issue a hazmana to begin with unless it determines that the claim at least passes some sort of muster, that assuming the truth of everything that was alleged as a possibility, maybe of some sort of a recovery, but assuming that it passes that type of muster, so then that would explain the minhag olam, that even if you haven't determined that it's more probable than not that the person is going to emerge victorious in their claim, and even if it's going to turn out that the secular court will award him much more in terms of penalty payments and further damages than what a Beis Din ever would have awarded him, nonetheless, the Beis Din doesn't further interfere because at that point it's understood essentially as a knas. The Ksam Sofer in a tshuva in a Simen Gimel in his tshuvos in Choshen Mishpat Simen Gimel, the Ksam Sofer explains that the essential basis of heter or kos in general is based on the notion that why is it that we said originally that you can't go to our kos? We said originally that you can't go to our kos because the our kos are promoting the name of elim, and they're promoting the system of secular courts, and it's undermining the system of halacha. But if the entire process is being presided over and supervised by the Beis Din, and it's the Beis Din that is utilizing the secular court essentially as its arm of justice, is saying we are overseeing the case, but under the circumstances, because of the party's recalcitrance, we are referring it to the secular court, we are delegating the secular court, then the secular court at that point becomes simply an arm and an agent of the Bez Din. And therefore, it no longer is Miyakeh Shem Alilim, it no longer is Mechalel Shem Shemayim, because it's still the Bez Din which is running the process, which is why, if we understand the reasoning of the Ksam Sofer, it makes sense that even if you have a situation where there could be a strong argument, based on the Gemara and Baba Kama, that a person would refuse under all circumstances to submit to Bez Din, it's still appropriate not to rely on the Kula of the Kesef Kachim to say, let's not summon him altogether. Number one, because who knows, maybe he will show up. But number two, because of the fact that it's important that there be an infrastructure of Bez Din involvement, so when it ultimately is assigned or delegated to the secular court, there will be essentially under the ultimate jurisdiction of the Bez Din, so that we won't run afoul of these other types of considerations. So that was the practice, certainly the Bez Din America, I think it's the practice of most Batei Din, that even if we know for sure that a person is most likely not going to submit, we make sure there's some sort of a Bez Din process before issuing a Heter Rav Kos. Now, in terms of once the Bez Din has actually issued its ruling, so do you need at that point in time a special heter to go to secular court to enforce the ruling? So Ruba Deruba of Poskim, there's an article that I have in the materials here by Ben Zion Yaakov Alevi Vosner on this subject. Ruba Deruba of the Poskim say that you definitely do not require an extra heter from Bez Din to enforce the Bez Din's ruling. And the simple reason for that as well is that once Bez Din has already been involved in the case, then it's obvious that the turning to secular court is not Miyakeh Shem Alilim, but if anything, is Miyakeh Shem Bez Din, is to give force and enforcement and teeth to the Bez Din judgment. So once it's clear that the Bez Din obviously wanted to render the judgment and wants the judgment to be enforced, so under those circumstances, it's basically, in Ruba the cases, self-understood that it is appropriate, if the other party is not complying, to then bring the decision of the Bez Din to the secular courts for enforcement purposes. As I mentioned before, whenever you have a case heard in front of Bez Din will require that the party sign a submission agreement to hear the case before Bez Din, to abide by the Bez Din's ruling, and then Bez Din, according to secular law, has the status of an arbitration tribunal, so that the written decision of the Bez Din will then be capable of enforcement by the secular courts. In my experience, at least at the Bez Din, whenever there was a case where one party brought the Bez Din's ruling to secular court for enforcement, it was always enforced by the secular court. That is essentially the application of the Mishnah in Gittin, where the Bez Din has already issued its ruling, and then it's appropriate to go to the secular court for the secular court to say, Asei ma she Yisrael omrim lecha, do what it is that the Jewish court is telling you to do. Can you, if there is a signed arbitration agreement, go to the secular court system before the Bez Din is paskin in order to compel the other party to appear before the Bez Din? So the Ramah has a comment, just so that it shouldn't surprise you, so I'll mention the comment. The Ramah has a comment, which the Ramah says, well, you shouldn't utilize the secular court system to enforce an obligation to go to Bez Din. So why is that? Why would you be able to enforce, why would you be able to go to secular court to enforce a Bez Din decision that's been rendered, but not to enforce the obligation to go to Bez Din in the first place? So what the Ramah was concerned about was just Mesira, that at that point in time, you're not enforcing a Bez Din ruling, you're just that the person did something wrong, but whenever you get somebody into trouble with the secular authorities, they might take much harsher action than is warranted, al pi the halakha. So therefore, if you can bring about the result in Bez Din, then that's the appropriate way to do it. Now, nowadays, Bez Din doesn't necessarily have the autonomous ability to compel parties to come in front of the Bez Din, so there may be no choice but to utilize the secular court system. But in sensitivity to this ruling of the Ramah, even if we say the Dine Mesira are not as big a concern nowadays in fair and just governments, which many argue, including the Tzitz Eliezer, nonetheless, it seems like it is appropriate, certainly, to go to the Bez Din first, and just to get the Rishus Bez Din, again, to comply with the Ksam Sofer notion of the Beis Din oversight of the entire process before compelling a party to come to Beis Din. That it's still appropriate for there to be Beis Din involvement before that actually takes place, even though one can argue that if you can do away with the Masiva concern, maybe you can do away with that Chumra as well. What about if you have a Chov Baror? So in a couple of Tshuvas, the Maharsham quotes the Avraham Buchach as a saying that whenever there is a chov baro, whenever there is a clear, unambiguous obligation that a person has, so under those circumstances, it is permissible just to collect the debt in civil court because you don't really have to have a case. It's just a collection of debt action. But I think that's kind of a very difficult heter to rely upon because in most cases, you don't satisfy the criteria of the Maharsham. And the criteria of the Maharsham is that there's no dispute whatsoever regarding the debt. However, in many cases, even though there's a clear debt, the other party might have counterclaims and might have mitigating factors which would argue against repayment of the debt. And whenever it's not a complete hodah, you do have to go to Beis Din. So if you don't know that there's a complete hodah, then it seems to me that one should not rely upon this kula and one should go to Beis Din first. I'll just conclude with the question of what about if you have an injunction? What about if you want to just freeze the other person's assets until such time as Beis Din can litigate the case? So here there's a short tshuva by Rav Moshe, which Rav Moshe indicates that as long as you're just doing it in order to be able to pursue the case in Beis Din, and you just don't want the person to run away with all of their assets, since Beis Din doesn't have the jurisdiction to issue an injunction, it would seem that it would be not be a violation of our codes just to go to them for an injunction, for injunctive relief, as long as it's made very clear that the actual case is going to be litigated in Beis Din and not litigated in a civil court. The only qualification that Shmuel Vosner has in his Shail Sechuva Shevet Alevi about this situation is that he says that ideally, if Beis Din can review the situation beforehand and just determine that there is a strong basis for the injunction, then it's advisable to do so. But one can distinguish between the Bati Din in Eretz Yisrael and outside of Eretz Yisrael. You could say, well, maybe, you know, if you are living in a country where there's a greater amount of jurisdiction, where Beis Din actually can preside over injunctive release determinations, that it makes more sense to get the Beis Din involved in that determination. Otherwise, there's a little bit of a downside, actually, if you get the Beis Din involved, because injunctive relief is usually pursued before both sides have collectively submitted to a Beis Din. If Beis Din gets involved in a case before both sides have collectively submitted to it, that creates the perception in the eyes of the other person that Beis Din might be biased against it, and that actually might be a factor against going to Beis Din before you have some sort of a mutual agreement when it comes to filing for injunctive relief. Another reason why it might make sense for somebody to file for injunctive relief, and then for the Beis Din to adjudicate the case afterwards. If the Beis Din already has adjudication of the case, then the model of Shmuel Vosner should be followed, of course, that it should be submitted by both parties to the Beis Din as to whether injunctive relief is appropriate or not in a given case. Bottom line, it's very important to promote the cause of making sure the parties have an appreciation of Beis Din, that we create the best and most effective the most responsive Bati Din to serve our communities, and that we make sure to spread the word amongst all of our Talmidim and amongst all of our brethren and sisters that this is a halacha that will help to bring Mi'etz Hashem, the Gula Shlema, that Tashir Shavtenegar Rishonah, Be'yotzenu Kibatzki Lav, Be'asim Imenu Yagon Banachah.